Mr. Chavez, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ernesto Chavez, and I represent Sebastian Lopez Gwen Dulain in this appeal. This is an Apprendi challenge under Shepard, as some prior cases have been. The specific issue is whether the district court's enhancement of Lopez's sentence for a first-time violation of 8 U.S.C. 1326 beyond the two-year maximum allowable under 8 U.S.C. 1326A violated Apprendi and Shepard because without the aid of a conclusive judicial record of defendant's agreement or a jury finding beyond a reasonable doubt, the court found that a prior conviction for a third-degree sexual assault involved a predicate fact that the victim was a minor at the time and therefore could not have consented to sex.
My question for you is similar to the question I had a couple of cases ago, which is why is the information in the criminal complaint in the underlying state case not the kind of thing that Shepard said is still fair game to look at? And it and some other things in this record indicate a person who's not obtained the age of 16 years, to wit HD, date of birth 9/19/85. So it doesn't require too much in the way of math skills to figure out that this was a girl of 14 at the time.
And you're referring to the information, correct, Your Honor?
Yeah, I'm looking at the criminal complaint. You attach quite a few things to your brief, but among them are a couple of things that have that. And there's also an information that says the same thing, the same, to wit, HD, DOB 9/19/85. Yeah. So we have that kind of solid information in this record that the court in Shepard said was permissible to consult.
Judge, that's correct. You do have that information that he had that information on the table, that is, the charging document on the table before him. You can consult that, Your Honor, under Shepard, but that in itself is not conclusive.
Why not? What evidence is there to the contrary?
Shepard
certainly does not require many trials about going behind
criminal
information.
Right, I agree with that.
Guilty.
Excuse me, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But that information is not enough without the defendant's assent under Shepard.
And when he pleads guilty, isn't he agreeing to at least what's written down in the information? This isn't like some of the cases where the plea of guilty would not necessarily include other underlying facts, but he certainly is pleading guilty to at least what's written down in this information.
Not in this case, Your Honor. And the reason for that is because what we have here, and it all boils down to the transcript, what he says in the transcript has to show assent to that information. The information alone is not enough. It can be considered. In the transcript, however, we have what I would describe as a wavering, equivocal, and uninformed plea, Your Honor.
But the judge would not have accepted it if it were that.
What I was thinking.
One would have hoped, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But in this,
you can't go behind conviction. The judge accepted the plea as voluntary and knowingly made, and he was sentenced forthwith. So,
well, I guess
are you making a collateral attack on the conviction as involuntary?
No, we are not making a collateral attack. And the reason is because it's the government's burden in this case, not our burden, to show that the assent was conclusive. In this case,
why isn't the judge's acceptance of the plea
conclusive evidence? Because the totality of the transcript indicates that this was a wavering plea. You have a situation where the defendant comes into court without even having been prepared by his attorney. That's the first thing. The second thing is it's a preliminary hearing, not a sentencing hearing ab initio at the beginning. It's a preliminary hearing. Suddenly, without preparation, the defendant is foisted into a sentencing hearing. And before that, it was clear that the attorney, in the transcript, the attorney had not prepared his client. And I would just cite, I'm sure Your Honors have seen the portion of the transcript, I would just cite that portion as being pivotal in this case.
I'm not sure you should even bother with that, because I don't know that there's any law to support the proposition that we can go behind the state judge's acceptance of the plea in the fact of the conviction. We're bound by that.
You're bound by a conviction. a conviction in which...
We're bound by the fact that the judge accepted the plea as knowing and voluntary, entered judgment of conviction, and sentenced the defendant.
Judge, I disagree with that, because the overwhelming evidence here, this transcript, is that the defendant didn't know what he was doing.
But and you see, if you're right, you really are backed into what you just told Judge Sykes you're not doing, which is a collateral attack on the conviction. Because certainly if somebody pleads guilty and is not knowing and voluntary and all the rest of that, that's invalid. That would be a reason for a collateral attack. Wisconsin, you may be too late or something, but assuming one did it in the correct time frame. So through the back door, it does sound like you're asking for a collateral attack, even though you probably quite properly recognize that this isn't the place to do it.
Judge, we're not. And I would acknowledge, I guess, that a collateral attack and an Apprendi challenge, such as in this case, could overlap, could arrive at a gray area. But we're not making a collateral attack. We don't need to, because it's not our burden of proof. And that's the crucial issue, because it's the government's burden of proof. Even though this seems like a collateral attack, what we're saying is the transcript, despite the information, is so rife with evidence that the defendant did not assent.
But the broader implication of what you're saying is you now want us, for all priors, whenever that may be relevant, and it's frequently relevant, when they happened in state court, we're supposed to sit down with the full state court record and go through and try to figure out were the jury instructions right, were guilty pleas properly taken, and in effect review what happened in the state court. Whereas, as Judge Sykes is pointing out, the Supreme Court has said quite to the contrary. We're supposed to take state convictions as givens. There is a conviction on this thing, and there are procedures for challenging them, of course, but in recidivist sentencing, we just have to take them as data and then figure out what they mean. What's the offense? What was the penalty range? Whatever.
Well, Your Honor, that's true. I agree with that. But, Your Honor, when the government brings the evidence and claims that this shows there's an assent, and when the government opens the door by bringing the transcript to fulfill their burden of proof, I think it's fair game for this court to hold, and this is what we're requesting, to hold that when there's... But when there's clearly an... Oh, Your Honor.
Yeah. What I want to ask you, I was just trying to find this. In the plea colloquy, it's 107-9 here. The court said to the defendant, "Do you have any trouble understanding me? The court as interpreted by the interpreter?" The defendant, "Yes." The court, "And he has had difficulty or doesn't have any difficulty?" And then the interpreter says, "No. He said that, yes, he is understanding everything." The court, "Oh, he understands. Okay. Does he understand his attorney, Mr. Osborne, through the interpreter?" The defendant, "Yes." The court, "And does he understand he's entering a plea of no contest?" "Yes." I mean, you keep going through this, and they're all yeses.
Judge, I would submit that given the way this preliminary hearing began, without the attorney not even meeting with the client, number one, and then admitting that he needed an adjournment of the full hearing to then prepare his client, and then after merely 20 minutes, maybe 22 minutes of an adjournment to be prepared for a plea hearing, that these yeses are in essence yeses to give me time served. I've been in jail for 225 days. This is why I'm entering this plea. Yeah, it's a yes. These are all yeses. But in the context of this transcript, these yeses are dubious, not conclusive.
But we would open the hugest Pandora's box in the history of, criminal pleas were we to agree with you, it seems to me. In other words, any time, I mean, you could say that about anyone who's using an interpreter, couldn't you?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no, because not in every case will the government bring the transcript, and a transcript that looks so obviously faulty as this one. And I would submit to you, when the government opens the door by using the transcript as conclusive evidence, and the transcript is not conclusive, and when the attorney is clearly unprepared, I believe the court ought to require the defendant himself to stipulate to the facts. I think that's in our brief. And I see that I've run into my rebuttal time. If I could.
I'm going to give you another minute.
Thank you.
Okay. So, thank you.
Good morning again, Your Honors. As this court has acknowledged, the government had a burden and it met its burden. The sentencing, prior to sentencing below, it provided a copy of the information as well as the underlying transcript of the guilty plea hearing. That's all that Shepard and Taylor require.
You're not arguing that third-degree sexual assault under Wisconsin law meets the definition here on its own without regard to the fact that this victim was 14? Or is that your argument?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Is it your argument that third-degree sexual assault under Wisconsin law meets the definition for purposes of the enhanced penalty here always, or that this particular third-degree sexual assault, because it involved a 14-year-old victim,
right,
meets the definition?
Plus, in the guidelines under Section 2L, which was the sentencing enhancement applied in this case, it says that sexual assault of a minor is a crime of violence for purposes of the guidelines. So then we did, yes, go back to Wisconsin, and we proved that through the sentencing transcript that it involved sexual assault and that it was of a minor. In this particular case, exactly. And that's why, again, the government went so far to meet its burden, because it's required to. And that's it. We are not here to, you know, I think the defendant is trying to wage a collateral attack on this prior conviction. That's not what we're here for today. It's, did the government prove, as it's required to under Shepard, that the defendant committed a crime of violence that then could be counted as an aggravated felony, you know, to get the enhanced penalty?
Why wasn't this classified as a forcible rape?
I have no idea.
It's Wisconsin's sexual assault scheme.
They pled it down. I mean, I think there's evidence in the record.
It was charged as a second degree.
It was charged.
Sexual assault of a child.
And they pled it down to third degree.
And the defendant was what? He was 23 at the time?
I believe so, yes. And again, with the victim's date of birth, she was 14. And it's also in our brief. She was impregnated, too.
She was pregnant, yeah.
So I
ask you something on a kind of different... you know, now the courts are no longer constrained by the guidelines, but are constrained only by the statutory maximum. Can a miscalculation of the statutory maximum ever be harmless error?
Well, even when you calculate the statutory maximums, like in this case it was 20 years, so infrequently are defendants actually sentenced to the statutory maximum. So I'm trying to think of an example where a defendant would have been sentenced to the statutory maximum and the government would have argued harmless error, because it's just so infrequent that they ever are sentenced to the statutory maximum. So even if the court miscalculated it, I guess that's when we would argue harmless error. If it was miscalculated but then subsequently wasn't applied, or, you know, the defendant wasn't sentenced to it.
Here's what I was thinking about. If a court thought a maximum was 20 years and was trying to sentence a defendant to a quarter of that, then a sentence would be 5 years. If the statutory maximum was 10 years, then the same 5-year sentence would be half the maximum, which might not have been what the court intended. In other words, when the court miscalculates the maximum, the court may think it's giving a light sentence, but it's actually giving a heavy sentence contrary to its intent. I mean, as a matter of principle, could such an error be harmless?
That's not what happened in this case, Your Honor. The statutory maximum was 20 years, and he was sentenced within the advisory guideline range.
He got 45 months?
Correct.
So very substantially less
than the statutory maximum, yes.
Well, here, let's see. Let me try and... It was 20 years if the alien had been, if an alien had been convicted of an aggravated felony. Right?
Yes. Which this is. This offense qualifies as, it qualifies as a crime of violence under Section 2L1.1, that's the sentencing guidelines. But then if you look under 1326B2, aggravated felony, that's what drives the statutory maximum of 20 years in this case. So under the statute, it's defined as an aggravated felony, but the guidelines use the term crime of violence. Really? Okay. So I'd ask the court affirm the judgment and conviction below.
Okay, well, thank you. Mr. Chavez.
Thank you, Your Honors. I understand I have 1 minute. Your Honors,
If you need to, take two.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't believe I'm asking the court to open a Pandora's box and look behind the documents that the prosecution is relying on. What I'm asking is when the prosecution decides to ask the court to find extrinsic facts, that in those circumstances, and the government relies on specific documents, that those documents have to show conclusive assent, Your Honor. Otherwise, we have a serious problem, and that is, of course, that the jury right is being violated. I just think that Shepard, with its language about court documents of conclusive significance, is flexible enough to allow for a holding that when the government relies on documents and it's not conclusive by their own filings, that violates Apprendi. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chavez, and thank you, Mr. Rumbelow. The case will be taken under advisement.